You are listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
I'm Albert Keidel, senior associate here at the Carnegie Endowment in the China program, and on behalf of Jessica Matthews, our president, and Doug Paul, our director, I welcome you heartily, and I hope you'll pump up your questioning spirit. We have such a distinguished group of professors here that you might think that you're getting ready for your dissertation oral review, but we're turning the tables because you get to ask them questions now about their most recent work. We're going to have about 45 minutes of presentation and then roughly another 45 minutes of questions from you and also from myself. I'm not going to go into the detailed introductions there on the handout at your place, but we have Professor Yunhan Chu, or if you speak Mandarin, it's Zhu, in the Wei Giles romanization they have here, Professor Larry Diamond, and Professor Andrew Nathan. I think they're going to start with Professor Zhu first, and then Professor Nathan, and then Professor Diamond. Is that right? Why don't we begin right in? I want to say that Bridge Street Books, a local bookseller that has quality books on sale, is out back in the lobby if you want to have the chance to purchase the book after the event, or in the middle of the event if you want to rush out. You can do that too. All right, why don't we begin right away with Professor Zhu.
Okay, good morning. Thank you all for coming. I also want to thank Albert for his fine introduction. He's one of the very few American moderators who pronounced my last name correct. Thank you for that. We will use up our 40 or 45 minutes in the following sequence. I will speak first for a few minutes, introducing you to our survey project. And then I will ask Andy to highlight some of the important findings that came out of our first wave survey. And at the end of his presentation, I will add a few footnotes based on some of the more recent data collected, you know, the, during last year and the year before. Then we will turn to Larry Diamond. He's really one of the experts in many important areas, including democracy support. So he will actually try to offer his view. What are the policy implications, for the next administration and for international donors in the area of democracy promotion? Let me use this PowerPoint to highlight some of the. Important feature of the survey project. This project was initially known and recognized as East Asia Barometer. We use the name Barometer, as we try to identify ourselves as one of the survey projects which are based in different regions. That have the mission to tap into the citizens' perception, evaluation, and their attitudinal orientation toward government, toward the incumbent regime, and also what they think of the quality of governance and to what extent they support democratic form of government. And before this project has established itself, there are three similar or comparable survey project has already been in place for many years, namely Latino Barometer, which covers 17 countries of the West Hemisphere, and also New Europe Barometer, launched by Professor Richard Rose, which covers the bulk of the Central and Eastern European country that belong to the former Soviet bloc. And also Afrobarometer, which has steadily increased its scope, starting from a country in Sub-Sahara, Africa, but now have grown into an operation which cover more than 18 countries, I believe. So we are the latecomer among the four regional barometer, but from the very beginning, you know, we have been very conscious of, you know, that we should create as much comparability across the four regions so that we can not only do intra-regional analysis but also cross-continental analysis as well. East Asia barometer, although we learn a great deal from the three predecessors, but at the same time, we also have our own research agenda and also try to identify questions that are more pertinent to the regional setting. For instance, that, you know, we would like to engage with the debate over Asian value, okay, whether there are certain set of region-specific value that, you know, might be either compatible or incompatible with the liberal democratic belief. And this is a truly regional initiative. We started out with 8 country teams, and it operates like a federation. So, you know, we have many collaborators involved in this project. Initially, you know, we were talking about more than 25, and nowadays, you know, 30-some. Most of them are very experienced political scientists and sociologists, or survey researchers. And many of them actually before, you know, joining this regional collaborative project, they have been a long-time observer, long-time researcher of their own country, especially in the area of public opinion and political culture and participation on those kind of topic. The project was financially sponsored by a few funding agencies, but primarily by Taiwan's education ministry. And also we get funding support from a number of national funding agencies, such as the Ministry of Education in Japan, Korea. And also we have some supplemental funding support from Henry Ruth Foundation and also the World Bank. And it takes a lot of money to complete a single round of cross-national survey. Because all our surveys are based on face-to-face interview, nationwide probability sampling. It's probably not that costly if you do a survey in a city, state, like or city, like Hong Kong. But it costs enormously to do a survey in a country like China. Or Indonesia, for the matter. But we try to make sure that every single individual have equal chance being selected, through our probability sampling. For our first wave survey, which was conducted mostly around 2002, some of the survey got started earlier than that. A few survey, was not completed until the early part of 2003. Most sample size are well above 1,000 cases, so we can do a lot of inferences, about the population with a high degree of confidence. And all the survey were under the guidance of standardized research protocol for quality control and also designed around standardized core questionnaire. And the data from the first wave survey right now is in the public domain. Actually, anyone sitting in this room, can go to our website, download a request form, and we can send you the raw data free. Okay? And then this, project, I think it become very well known among political scientists and sociologists. We got at least 180 requests, over the last few years for getting access to this data set. And also we got many citations. And at the same time, you know, if you go to our website, there's one entry that can take you into another facility. It's an online retrieval system that you don't have to be a quantoi. You don't have to know anything about SPSS or statistics. You can just, you know, pick the country you want, pick the variable, the indicator you want, and then it will produce a pie chart for you, a bar chart for you, or it can even produce a cross tabulation for you if you pick, you know, two indicators at the same time, and you can, and they all become downloadable. Although you have to pay a small fee for getting that value-added survey, which is not done by us, by a Spanish, you know, survey organization. The initial emphasis in our survey was placed on the five emerging democracies in the region, namely Thailand, the Philippines, Mongolia, South Korea, and Taiwan. Because we really would like to know to what extent these newly democratized countries, you know, they are progressing toward democratic consolidation, whether democracy enjoy a robust, you know, popular support, and to what extent, you know, the performance of the new regime live up to people's expectation. You know, we want to ask questions like that. At the same time, we also bring in other interesting and important significant political system for comparative purpose. Number one, Japan, which is the only consolidated democracy in the region, and also China, which has emerged as probably the most important player in the region, shaping the political landscape, you know, the geostrategic landscape of East Asia. And also Hong Kong, you know, since, you know, that territory, even though it's no longer, you know, a truly independent entity, but, you know, but still, you know, it carries a lot of significant and also its own, with its own distinctive feature, you know, so... and also we have a long-time relationship with the surveys research in Hong Kong, so we are also glad, you know, to be able to include that. The project moved on to its second stage in year 2005 when we, you know, began our second wave survey, began the planning stage of a second wave survey. And this time we are able to recruit five more country teams from Southeast Asia. And these five cases are Indonesia, Vietnam, Singapore, Malaysia, and Cambodia. So literally, at the end of our second wave survey, this project it has just acquired a new identity. It's now called itself Asian Barometer. Not only, you know, we are able to cover virtually all the major political systems in East Asia, but also we enter into kind of cooperation with our South Asian collaborator. They also conduct a comparable survey in five South Asian countries, so make this entire effort a true Pan-Asia initiative. The data from the second wave has not been able to be analyzed in time when we wrote up this book. So the book is primarily based on the first wave survey. But during today's presentation, you know, I would show you a little bit, you know, what are the latest figures, you know, look like, you know. But before that, you know, we will focus primarily on the finding from our first wave survey. Now I will turn to Andy for that.
Thank you. So as Yunhan said, the survey is anchored around the five new democracies. But when we look at the book is written in country chapters, but when we look at the data across the systems, something jumps out at us, not only about the five new democracies, but about China and Japan, with respect to the top two rows of this table, regime support. When we ask people, when all is said and done, our form of government is best for us, we found that actually the Chinese gave the highest percentage of agreement to that, and the Japanese the lowest percentage, although we know, and we haven't changed our view, that Japan is a working, functioning, consolidated democracy, and China is an authoritarian system, and many theories would suggest that the people groaning under the yoke of authoritarianism shouldn't be happy, but that turns out to be not true. They're pretty happy about the form of government, whatever they think that is. But in asking that question, we were really trying to not tell them what the form of government is, but, and not to ask them about the current leaders or policies, but to ask about the underlying regime, and they seem to think that it's pretty good. And we also find that in the new democracies in the region, some of the publics are not very happy about the form of government. For example, in Korea, that's rather striking, a hard-won democratic transition, and some years later a feeling that maybe the form of government is not best for us. If you ask people, how satisfied are you with the way democracy works in our country, which is actually a question that can reasonably be asked, or which makes sense, let's put it that way, to the respondents in all of these systems, because all of the governments present themselves as democratic, including that in China, we again find that the satisfaction with how, you know, the system works is pretty high in China, and it's not that high in Japan, although this question elicits more higher levels of support than asking that kind of a question in the first way. Also interesting is the column on trust in government institutions, where we find here we asked about a number of government institutions, breaking it down. We asked about the legislature, the police, the army, and I forget all which,
the courts,
the bureaucracy, and then averaged out the level of trust. The level of trust in China is very high. Again, in Japan, it's low. Korea, it's low. Taiwan, it's not very high. It's certainly under 50%. Now, why are these slides in the wrong order now?
I don't exactly know, but
we'll have to jump around. Okay. So now we asked people one open-ended question in the whole survey, because they're very expensive to ask, which is, what does democracy mean to you? And we got back answers in people's own words. And then we had coders who went through and classified these answers into different categories, which produces not a very revealing table. In the book, we break it out, and each chapter author talks about what people actually said. And in that way, the right interpretation of this table, which is not really evident on the face of it, is that the Chinese gave the highest percentage of answers what we classified as by and for the people. What they really were talking about is socialist democracy, harmonious society. The government cares about the people. The government is responsive to the people. So they were reflecting there that they have heard the message from the propaganda department of the CCP about what democracy is supposed to be, and they accept that definition in large part, as well as each person could give up to three answers. So there are also many Chinese saying it's freedom and liberty, which is something that the Chinese regime doesn't deny either. I mean, that's part of their argument, is that, you know, people have it's in the Chinese constitution, freedom of press and assembly and so forth, or political rights, institutions and processes, meaning democracy is about elections. It's about the popular sovereignty. So generally, the Chinese public gave an interpretation of democracy that was pretty consistent with the official interpretation. Other publics are less clear about it. In Taiwan or in Japan, you see a lot of diversity of views. People don't have a crisp, clear idea. It's striking that in Japan, 35.5% of the people didn't know. We find that it's our Japanese team, who are distinguished social psychologists, Ikeda Kenichi and other people, have a lot of experience doing surveys in Japan. They say you often get a lot of high don't know in Japan on questions that require people to not just say what they did or didn't do, but to express an opinion or take a stand, that Japanese don't like to do so that much. So when we ask people whether they like democracy, they would be answering that question from their own conception of what democracy is, not a conception that we imposed on them. We designed a series of questions to, can everybody see okay? I see some squinting around on that. Can you see? Or should we try to move the angle of the, it's all right. The size.
Slides, Andy.
It's the damn slides themselves. All right. Anyway, we designed a series of questions in which we were trying. Buy the book.
Yeah, buy the book. It's in the book, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Rush out now, as Bert said. a series of questions that were designed to elicit information about people's support for democracy as a brand name. Not what we think it is or what the Freedom House thinks it is, but whatever you think it is, do you think that's a brand name that you like? So we asked the first question, and one of the interesting things on this table is that whichever country you choose to look at, each number is lower than the number above it. There's a decline in the value of that brand name as you pose that question in different ways. And the other interesting thing on this table is to look across the different countries at that comparison. But let's start with the first point. If you say to people, how desirable is democracy for our country now on a scale of 1 to 10? A pretty strong number in every country would give it a desirability above 6, 6 or above, above 5, 6 or above. So it's desirable. It's a good thing. Is it suitable for our country now is the second question. It is suitable, but it's not as suitable as it is desirable. So some doubts enter in that, you know, we'd love to have it, but maybe not right now. Do you think democracy is effective in solving the problems of society? And there's a large fall off in some of the countries in the percentage of people who think it's effective. Then if you ask, is it preferable to all other forms of government, which is a kind of choice, it's a significant fall off, and it goes below 50% in quite a few of the countries in Taiwan and Korea. It goes below 50%. Then we imposed in the last question in the series a forced choice between democracy and economic development, which I personally would consider a false choice, but as a attitudinal question, since many people see that kind of a trade-off, we said, is democracy equally or, you know, comparing democracy to economic development, is it less important, equally important, or more important? If you, the numbers who say it's more important are very, very low. But the numbers who say it's equally or more important, which is the number we've recorded here, is below 50% everywhere but in Thailand. This is the time when we did the survey in Thailand. It was the honeymoon period of the Thaksin regime, and all of our Thai data show a great deal of enthusiasm and optimism about democracy, which Yun Han will show you in the second wave. There's been some fall off in that attitude. In the book, we do portray the historical context of the survey in each country because we certainly think that's important. We don't think that we're tapping, well, in most cases, we don't think we're tapping attitudes that are impermeable to political events. It's quite the contrary, although there are some attitudes I'll show you later which we think are more kind of deep-seated. So this was a happy time in Thailand, but in the other countries, economic development trumps democracy by, in some cases, by, you know, Obama-like or even more numbers. So in, for example, Hong Kong, Taiwan, the Philippines, and then even in Japan, only 44, you know, so the other only 44% felt that democracy is equally or more important. Now, it's another question if you ask people about democracy without using the word democracy. And we think this is quite important. And so from our position as political scientists, we have taken it upon ourselves to kind of define what we think are the core values that go undergirding any kind of democratic system. And this questionnaire battery has a long, long history. It was actually created by Zhu Yunhan's PhD advisor, Professor Hu Fo, who's kind of a granddaddy of our whole project in a way. I don't know if you can read this or not, but we've put the value that we're trying to assess into square brackets. So there are five values. Political equality, we think, is a core value of democracy. Separation of powers, government accountability, political liberty, and pluralism, political pluralism. And we've asked two questions to assess some of these values. There are two pluralism questions. There are two accountability questions up here and here. And we've arranged them in the order of average agreement across the entire region. And the way that you ask this question, for example, with political equality, is to say people with agree or disagree, people with little or no education should have as much say in politics as highly educated people. So again, with a table like this, you can compare it from the top down, or you can compare it running across from the left to the right. And we've arranged this table from the highest to the lowest average. You can't put too much meaning into these averages, but they provide you with a kind of anchor point for interpreting numbers. So one of the striking things is that the principle of political equality is very well rooted in Asia. So if somebody comes to you, Kishore Mahbubani or any other friend of ours, and says Asians don't believe in political equality, that person would be wrong. I don't think that Kishore would say that, actually, but he might. he might even say that. But not in Thailand. This is quite striking, and our Thai team can give you a whole lot of sort of interpretive analysis of how the Thais see this issue. But as you go down the line, you find that, in particular, the value of that Kishore would be right. The value of political pluralism in the region is really not very widely accepted at all. The green numbers are under 50%, and the red numbers are above 50%. And in these two rows, there's only these three red numbers that are above 50%. Two of them are in Korea. So that tells you something about Korea and their belief in pluralism and in, you know, doing political battle, which we probably know from the history of Korea. One of the comforting things is the way that the numbers we've collected kind of map onto things that we already knew, but we didn't know it at this level of percentages. Yeah.
Or should we assume that don't knows are relatively low, so that the
well, numbers are in this case, I don't think you can assume that don't knows are relatively low. We'd have to break that out, and I don't have Yunhan probably does know, but this table is the percent giving the pro-democratic answer. So the other percentage, that the opposite percentage, incorporates the don't knows along with those who gave, well, disagree is not quite the right way to say it, because the questions are flipped in some ways. So sometimes disagree is the democratic answer. So, but the residuum includes the don't knows in this particular table, and each table is constructed differently. So democratic values are uneven across the landscape. They're very high in Japan. So here are the poor Japanese people, and this is one of the pictures that we get. You know, they're kind of trapped betwixt and between. They don't think their form of government is all that great. They're not that satisfied with it. They don't give that enthusiastic an endorsement. It's not that bad, but it's not the most enthusiastic endorsement in the region toward the D word. But then when you probe to their actual values, they have quite strong, well-rooted democratic values. And the Thais, who loved democracy when we talked about it in the survey, they are not really that committed to what we think it means. And the Chinese are in the middle and not that strongly rooted with democratic values by the comparison across the region. And the unevenness also pertains to the items themselves. Now, if you said to people, okay, you know, you're not that happy with democracy, do you want to go another way? We have a series of batteries, you know, do you agree or disagree? Let's get rid of democracy and let a strong leader govern. let's get rid of it and have military rule, have no opposition party, have experts decide everything. We only asked two of these questions in China because the other two they already have, you know, and they're getting toward experts decide everything too. But anyway, this we think is a strong measure of consolidation because, in a way, you know, you might not be happy with democracy, but if you're not willing to go to the alternative, you're kind of stuck with it. And that's pretty much the picture for the Japanese. But some of the countries, people are willing, like Mongolia, certainly, to consider a strong leader. I'll go to the last. When you said 3 minutes, does that cover him or just me? Okay. Okay. All right. You're done. All right. Let me.
Yeah. No.
Yeah. Okay. That's fine. We'll go to we'll go to Larry.
A total of 12 minutes left
between all of us.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay. So I'm. That's fine. So I'm just going to say that we think that satisfaction with the current form of government is very much affected by performance. You know, the people there are very realistic, and in general, they are happy with the fact that the new governments, even in China, have given them a lot more freedom. That's what we call democratic performance. But they're pretty much unhappy across the region with performance on corruption, law and order, and economic things. And so I think, Yunhan, if you want to say just a couple of these slides, and then we'll go to Larry.
Okay. I just want to share with you a few more tables and figures, you know, if you haven't had enough by now. But I'm sure that, you know, people would be interested in knowing what has happened over the last few years. Between our first and second wave survey, in most countries, there are five years in between. So that provide you some perspective about, you know, what direction this country has moved. The overall picture in the region that a lot of countries have not moved in the right direction. Begin with this satisfaction with the way democracy works question. As you can see that, in case of like Japan, it started off on a rather low level and it didn't get much, you know. It remained, you know, below 50% level of satisfaction. And Taiwan have made some steady increase, which is kind of encouraging. But still, you know, the absolute level is not very high. Look at, you know, what has happened in Philippines. The satisfaction level have dropped from 52 to 37. That's almost 14 percentage point decline, and also about 10 point percentage point decline in the case of Thailand, and also substantial decline in Korea, and also a little bit, you know, decline in Mongolia. And then if we turn to this one of the widely used indicator for democratic legitimacy, we ask people, you know, whether democracy is always preferable to other form of government under all circumstances. People who gave positive answer, you know, are reported here in terms of percentage. Look at, you know, what had happened on this indicator in the case of Mongolia. You know, has dropped from 54% to below 40%. Okay, that's a very, very significant drop within 5 years. In the case of the Philippines, again, you know, you have witnessed a considerable drop in terms of, you know, people's, you know, the preference over democratic form of government. Same story, you know, taking place in Thailand. And also you see a little bit step back in the case of Korea as well. So among the five emerging democracies, you know, four out of five, you know, we have witnessed some setback rather than advance. Then if we come to the question about the efficacy of democracy, you know, can democracy solve the problems of the society? Again, you witness that, a substantial number of people in different countries have lost their confidence about the effectiveness of democracy. Here that in Korea, have dropped from 71% to 52%. In the Philippines, also some significant drop, and in Thailand, as Larry or have already alerted you, maybe Andy have alerted you earlier that this is where the fail off looked like from 89% to only 66%. So this is again not a very reassuring sign. What about whether there are more people that are willing to consider non-democratic alternative? Unfortunately, yes, we also witness, it's happening right now in a lot of countries. For instance, in Mongolia, in 2002, 60% of our respondents, they registered objection, to the alternative, that get rid of election, get rid of parliament, have a strong leader to decide everything. But now many people are yearning for that kind of non-democratic alternative. Only 36% registered objection to the possibility. And we have witnessed some similar, but although not as dramatic, decline in terms of, objection to authoritarian alternative in the case of Philippines and Thailand. So let me wrap up, in this way that, democracy, I would argue that in quite a few East Asian countries, they are struggling. Maybe they are not under immediate danger of collapsing, but the trend line doesn't look good. I'll stop right here and turn the podium to Larry.
I'll speak to very briefly, to two issues in terms of policy implications. One is, what are the implications in terms of keeping the democracies we have in Asia and the East Asia? There is a South Asian barometer, but we're not talking about that data. And secondly, what are the prospects for initiatives or orientations, if not policies, that might help to bring about democratic change in the authoritarian countries of the region? Let me speak about keeping democracy first and build exactly on what Yun Han has just said. We see in our survey from the first wave to the more recent second wave, what the naked eye can also see looking at East Asia, which is democratic trouble. Particularly in Thailand and the Philippines, a certain degree of angst, disappointment, disillusionment, and erosion in support for democracy. I think this is particularly worrisome in the Philippines. You just saw the figure that Yun Han put before us, that the percentage of people in the Philippines who believe democracy is always preferable declined between these two waves of surveys from 64% to 51%. Satisfaction with democracy declined from 52% to 38%. We see some erosion on some measures in the more established democracies, Korea, Taiwan, Japan, but I'm not so worried about the survival of democracy in these countries. They have serious problems. When you have presidents, not long into their tenure, like President Ma in Taiwan and President Lee in Korea, dropping to 10% in public approval ratings, it's worrisome. It took George Bush a long time to get to 25% public approval, and it took them, a matter of months to get down to 10 or 15%. So we can't take anything for granted. But what we find in our survey analysis of the democracies of East Asia is generally what other analysts have found, particularly in Africa and the post-communist world, in terms of the determinants of support for democracy. Satisfaction with the way democracy works seems to be more sensitive to short-term economic performance. And my prediction is, I don't think it's a very adventurous one, that economies are going to perform even more weakly in East Asia in the next couple of years or so because of the global recession that is kind of washing across the world. And it's likely, although there are various ways of framing and buffering this that might modify this possibility, it's likely that this will further depress satisfaction with the way democracy is working generally in the region. But support for democracy as a system of government, as a preference, seems, and also rejection of authoritarian alternatives, which together seem to be the sort of opinion pillars of democratic consolidation. These respond more, it appears, to popular perceptions of what we call in our book political performance than economic performance. That is, to what extent do people perceive that government is working to control corruption? To what extent do people perceive that they have responsive and accountable government with free and fair elections? If you ask what happened in the Philippines between the first wave of our survey and the second wave of our survey, one of the things that happened is that there was a presidential election, and after the presidential election, an audio tape surfaced of a conversation between President Gloria Macapagal Arroyo, who, because of particular dynamics in the Philippines, had a unique opportunity to seek re-election, and the head of the Electoral Commission, in which she appeared to be trying to ensure that she was going to get the result that she was seeking and that perhaps they had previously agreed upon. And this was coming at a time when, patrimonial politics, corruption, clientelism, what's called in the literature on the Philippines guns, goons, and gold as phenomena in Philippine politics were reasserting themselves. In Thailand, I think you're all familiar with the drama of Prime Minister Thaksin, the polarization of the country, the paralysis and so on that has disillusioned a lot of Thai citizens. My suspicion is if we did these two surveys right now, today, in Thailand and the Philippines, we'd find even more erosion, probably much more dramatic erosion in Thailand in particular. So in terms, and we can't take Indonesia for granted, even though surprisingly, as a new or recent democracy, Indonesia is doing relatively better in some respects than these other two. So there's an obvious agenda here in terms of making significant commitments to improve governance in the new democracies of Asia. And I'd say since the challenge for the United States is not to provide democracy assistance to Korea and Taiwan. There are other ways of engaging these two democracies and affirming democratic partnerships and principles. But I do think we need to have a substantial presence for democracy and governance assistance in the Philippines, in Thailand, in Indonesia. And Thailand is a country that we kind of got out of a number of years ago, and maybe we need to go back into it in terms of significant flows of aid to strengthen political institutions, to support civic education, support democratic civil society organization, support groups inside and outside the state that are working to improve the quality, transparency, and responsiveness of democratic governance, and obviously in Thailand as well, to try and bridge this crippling polarization between two political camps, neither of which has exhibited very much commitment to democracy. Now, to come briefly to the authoritarian regimes, the two that really interest me and where our data, I think, show something fascinating from the first wave China from the second wave, China. We don't have the second wave data from China yet, but Vietnam behaves in rather similar ways, I think. And let's just look at the first wave data. We see that 95% of Chinese say our form of government is best, and 97% expect democratic progress. Those are both extraordinary numbers. It says to me, I say this with great humility in the presence of Andy Nathan, and maybe he'll react to it, that, you know, they're happy transitionally, but they won't be happy 10 years from now if there's no change in the nature of the Chinese system. Another way of saying this is to offer the prediction that modernization in China and Vietnam, which continue to grow at, you know, phenomenal rates, although this is obviously going to slow in the next 2 or 3 years, is going to drive political change. Now, I'll close with these numbers. We look not only at support for democracy, but at, as Yunhan was saying, liberal values. You get beneath the, you know, open the hood of the car and really see what's in there in terms of the architecture of support for democracy. Should judges decide cases independently or take instruction? 31% of Chinese support that concept on the mainland, 54% in Taiwan. Should political leaders have to follow constitutional procedures? 47% in mainland China, 76% in Taiwan. Should government decide which ideas are allowed to circulate in society? 37% in mainland China, 72% in Taiwan. I could go on, but the point is this. If you look 20 years ago at what the levels of support were for these more liberal dimensions of democratic values in Taiwan, they were pretty close to or even worse than what we find in mainland China today. And we're lucky to have, as a result of Professor Hu Fu's work, first of all, these questions, and second of all, a time series of over 20 years. So, you know, my feeling is we shouldn't be apathetic about trying to support political reformers in China, even very incrementally, in terms of trying, for example, to make the National People's Congress a somewhat more autonomous and representative institution, or push judicial independence a little bit. We certainly should be trying where we can to support civic pluralism, even though doing it may need to take relatively non-political forms in terms of what U.S. donors do in China. But basically, I think the most important thing to bring about democratic change in China and Vietnam is economic development. These political systems, I'm not sure Andy agrees with this, but I will make this prediction, cannot survive in the face of modernization. You're going to have more conscious, educated, organized, connected, wired populations that are not going to stand for the level of political control from the center that now exists in these two countries. And I think we see signs of effervescence and, you know, normative change that augurs well for the future. So if I were a policymaker, I'd want to keep pushing. I'd want to press the Chinese leaders to release human rights activists from jail, allow a freer society, and so on. But if you're thinking strategically for the long run about fostering democratic change in these countries, you know, economic development is going to be the most powerful agent of it.
Well, I hope you agree with me. That was a fascinating array of ideas and statistical findings. I wanted, before we get to the question period, to make sure that everybody knows what the website is. I couldn't see it clearly there. Can you say, tell us what the website URL is?
Just
Google Asian Barometer.
Okay, yeah, it's www.asianbarometer.org.
Okay, great.
All one word.
And I wanted to say that it doesn't come out in the presentation, but in the book itself, there's quite, to my mind, a valuable, concise summary of the thinking and political economic thinking dimensions involving public opinion and sentiment in a population towards democracy. And there's been a to and fro in the history of, seems to me, political thought, at least in Andy's introduction to the book, that helped me a lot, so that there's a framework, not just statistical results, but there's a framework provided in the book about how to think about this whole approach.
And if you want to say any more words of praise, we're happy to yield some of our time to you.
Well, what I want to do is I'm going to ask three questions, one maybe of each of you, very quickly, on the kinds of themes that jump out to me. As you know, I'm an economist, so this thesis of economic performance is important. And in a recent article in a book published by Brookings, Professor Nathan has compared progress, but just describing democracy, as, if I remember it correctly, as success in having the election of top officials be the way that they're chosen, direct election of top officials. And what fascinates me is how do you think about getting to that process? Because Irma Adelman is an old name in economic development who has chronicled at what stages in economic development you get parliamentary democracy appearing, you also get ability to control pollution arriving at a certain stage and other things that correlate with per capita GDP in some way. So it follows on what you were saying at the end. Is there a path to a healthy democracy? Because we may have examples here, it looks like, in cases where the democracies aren't so healthy. And so I'm interested in, Andy, in your view about that theoretical framework in thinking about what is not a healthy democracy or a non-healthy democracy, not just an on or off for now, but is someone on a healthy path or on the path that may lead to elections but under pressure of democratization or even corruption, but in fact isn't a well-functioning one. And I was interested in the book on the description in Taiwan when this was taken, there were controversies around independence. And this was seen as causing all kinds of dysfunctional behavior on the part of parliamentarians and other members of the political sort of actors guild in Taiwan. And that's, I don't mean to make that sound the way it does. So in Thailand, you know, the results here showed not a lot of interest in having people with low education have political rights. But this whole boiling up of problems in Thailand from all the analysis, very little analysis before what I hear, it has to do with the urban area not happy with the results that were the result of a larger rural population's vote than has been the case in the past. So it's actually, you could say, a sign of democracy working in Thailand, that you're having all of this unrest at the urban center of the political body. And so I'm interested in what combination of basic malfunctioning at a social level can be responsible for what we might say is a malfunctioning of the democracy and the democratic institutions as we watch them actually functioning. And Professor Diamond, I'm interested in terms of U.S. policy in then. How can we focus, and you mentioned it a little bit here, but more on the workings that might lead in a more dynamic process of understanding how democracies evolve. What can the U.S. do to say, all right, they may not have a democracy now in this or that country, even a Burma, but I would wonder about what this implies about engaging egregious regimes as we see them around the world as perhaps the best step towards developing democratic forces there rather than isolating them. So those are my three questions, 1, 2, 3. And if you want to just give short, curt answers so we can get to the audience, that's fine.
Taiwan.
All right.
In Thailand. Yeah.
Bert says, is there a path? I mean, our data do show that as these are not diachronic data, they're synchronic data, but you can investigate change by comparing different segments of the population.
So what do those two words mean? Those diachronic.
Yeah, I'm going to make a historical statement, which is diachronic, and say that as people become more educated, as they become more urban, as they have a higher income. We do find that values change, but how can I know that when we only have one slice of time? And the answer is, you know that by comparing subsets of the population. So that's synchronic. Economists know these things. The data do suggest that as modernization proceeds, interpreting modernization as all of the things I just mentioned, the basic values of democracy will increase. And I think when we showed, for example, in that table that large percentages in every country except Thailand believe in political equality, that wouldn't have been the case in the 19th century or the 18th century. So change happens. So if Bert wants to be comfortable and say there is a path, you know, that takes many centuries, and we can be up in the clouds and look down on the planet Earth and say sooner or later you people will work it all out.
I was thinking decades, because I taught school in Taiwan back in the 60s.
Things do change, but I think this survey is a little bit more down closer to Earth, saying that it's a big struggle. In the transition phase, the authoritarian regimes are not just sitting there letting modernization kind of wash over them. They take advantage of it. They use the internet. They use urbanization. They use education. They use mass media. And they have proven to be more resourceful, I think, than we foresaw, maybe because they have more at stake, you know, than we had, in a sense, because they were had to survive. And on the other side of it, with the democracies, they also cannot just kind of sit there in the blue house and let modernization lift all ships. They face, as you were saying in your question, the struggles in Thailand between the rural and the urban, the struggles in Taiwan between the identity groups, and sharp struggles everywhere. And so at this level of investigation that we are at, we see these processes being much more turbulent than the theory. So when Larry says the systems can't survive in the face of modernization, that's the Olympian view. That's not the view that I'm, talking about. So he and I are talking at different maybe levels. Yunhan.
I think there's a strong consensus among students of democracy, to underscore the importance of a consolidated nation state on which, a consolidated democracy can be built up. If you don't have a strong consensus among the citizen about the boundary of the national community, or its national sovereign status, you are witnessing a very fragile political institution built on a very shaky foundation. I think that probably carries some element of truth when you look at Taiwan. We have a very polarized division over national identity. Who we are. Are we Chinese? Are we Taiwanese? What should be the future of the island? But on the other hand, the polarized conflict over national identity can be even worse. We are fortunate that that division has not so far torn apart our democracy. It created a lot of problem. Created a lot of strain on our system. But fortunately, we are not as contentious as divided in the case of Cyprus, in the case of Sri Lanka, in the case of Lebanon. So things could become even worse. So relatively speaking, we managed to deal with the underlying conflict with some degree of success, although notwithstanding the fact that we are still troubled by it, mm-hmm. we continue to be troubled by it. Secondly, I think Thai system is also pretty much overburdened by this polarized conflict of a different nature, as people often said that the Thai government is always elected in the countryside and toppled in Bangkok. Okay, the middle class node and various more operate in the modern sector, they couldn't really put up with, you know, the kind of nepotism or gravy train kind of politics that, you know, is well managed by those politicians, with all kind of those traditional practices, but they make them very popular, you know, in the countryside. So that, you know, lead to this unfortunate, you know, outcome, that is to say, the middle class voter in Bangkok, they are outnumbered by even larger population in the countryside. So they don't want to accept the outcome of the democratic process. You know, they try to be as disruptive, you know, as they can, to extend that, you know, election can no longer bring out a definitive outcome, you know, dealing with those conflict. I think that's very unfortunate, and that oftentimes, you know, paved the road for the military intervention and occasionally with the backing of the monarch.
Just briefly, I think that, you know, if you can't, by isolating an egregious regime, bring it down pretty quickly, it gets pretty pointless to pursue a strategy of pure isolation. And so, yes, I would favor moving toward more engagement, and in particular more presence in Burma, larger embassy and so on. What you don't want to do is reward a rapacious and extremely repressive regime with flows of aid and investment that are mainly captured by the regime rather than finding their way to the people. So you've got to be very careful and clever about it to engage in a way that generates flows that actually reach the people and generate economic development. And not simply empower and entrench the regime. And I think that's the challenge in Burma today. And, you know, no one has quite figured it out. You know, obviously it's much easier to deal with authoritarian regimes like China and Vietnam that are developing, where, you know, the logic of isolation has long since, I think, wisely been abandoned.
Well, with that, why don't we begin with questions? I see a lot of hands, and I'm going to just start when I if you have a very short intervention on exactly the same question so we just don't boing around between topics, you can raise two fingers. I'm going to recognize out of sort of seniority perhaps Michael Swain in the back, and then I'll move to others going forward.
Start with the most extreme.
I don't know about that.
The tallest. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. I haven't read the book, and I apologize in advance. And you may have this answered. You may have this clearly explained in the book. But I, based on your presentation and the
You can
graphs,
buy it, Michael, out back.
Yeah, $50. Okay, I'll think about it. it's a little steep. But I, based on your graphs and the presentations, I have to admit I'm a little frustrated in trying to get my arms around what the bottom line is here, if there is a bottom line. And that's in terms of the essential definition of what you're measuring or what you're trying to examine. It seems at the beginning of your presentation, somebody said, we didn't come in with a definition of democracy. We let the respondents interpret democracy as they understood it. But then it seems to me that when you do that, it's almost impossible to then go ahead and say in subsequent graphs, and therefore the position on democracy is such and such. In other words, it seems to me there needs to be a common understanding here. Are you looking at a phenomenon that most people would accept and understand as democracy in all of these countries? And if your argument is there is no standard, there is no basic definition of essential attributes of democracy, then it seems to me you're lost in relativism. And democracy can mean almost anything. to the people that you're talking to. And it can really devolve into simple questions of competence. They associate a competent government with a democratic government. If it's doing better for them or by them, it's more democratic. And I would say that most people who support democracy or understand democracy, at least in the West, would completely reject that argument. I'm just, all I'm trying to do is say, is there a basis for measuring if democracy is understood as a common value among the people you're examining, and if they recognize it as a reality in terms of the process, the political process that they're looking at? And I didn't see that coming out of the presentation.
All right, I have, because he's a very good friend of mine, held up a card like this that says, please wrap up, and I may use it with others of you that I don't know so well. Please don't take it in the wrong sense. We've got a few good minutes. That was, of course, an excellent question. Who would like to respond?
So we're interested in several different, describing several different variables. One of them is, in fact, the democratic values, where we know what they are, five values, and we want to see if people agree with those values. We're also interested in describing people's what we call diffuse regime support. You know, you have a regime. We know what that regime is, too. Freedom House will tell us what a regime it is. We accept that kind of a definition, and we just want to know, do people support that regime? We're interested in trust in institutions. They have the institutions that they have, and we want to know what kind of trust they express, and so forth. So we're interested in a number of things descriptively that are different. We recognize, like you, that those are different variables. Then we're interested in a number of causal pathways, which you also alluded to. So one of those causal pathways is one that you described as, you know, if, I forget how you put it exactly, but if the government performs well, are people going to give them higher grades on these various dependent variables? So I think we're interested in all of the things you talked about, and we do know that each of those is a different thing, so we've measured each one of those things with a different set of questions. If you say, is there a takeaway bottom line from this, there are several. One of the striking ones is the level of diffuse regime support being so high in China and so low in some of the other places. I mean, there are a variety of different takeaway points, but I think we've kind of framed it around the idea that democracy is in some distress, not about to fall over the edge of the cliff, but not doing as well as we had probably anticipated in the heyday of democratic transition, when we thought now that they have a real democracy, things are going to be hunky-dory. That turns out to be excessively optimistic.
All right, I'm going to go on hands that I saw them. This gentleman here in the second row.
Thanks. Blair King from USAID. My question picks up on Larry's final statement, but any of you free to respond. And that is your point about strategically economic development being the most important thing driving democratization over the long term in China and Vietnam. And my question is, well, but doesn't it matter what kind of economic development? And if the obvious answer to that question is yes, then if you could drill down a little further and talk about sort of both what kinds of economic development are important in that regard, and are both the governments of those countries and our own policies supporting the quote-unquote right kinds of economic development. And in particular, I'm reminded, I think on Monday here, in fact, there's a presentation on another new book that argues that at first China's economic development is much more focused on the private sector and smaller enterprises, but in recent decades is focused much more on large state enterprises and whether that's... Yeah. Anyways.
I'd say two things. Number one, we know that it helps if economic development generates a multiplicity of small enterprises and not just big enterprises, that small enterprises and entrepreneurs are much more likely to defect from the state or the party state to democracy, as happened in Taiwan. Big enterprises like the Chaebol in Korea, the big companies in Brazil during the military dictatorship there are much more likely to get intertwined in sort of state-capital relationships. That's one thing. But secondly, you know, in the end, Korea democratized, and the Chaebol just kind of, you know, swung behind the new regime and worked it. And so in the long run, and here I must say I'm very influenced by Engelhardt and Wetzel's recent book on modernization and social change. I realize I shouldn't be plugging a different book this morning, but it's a very stunning one. And
Prince Street Books might have it.
You know, it's the point is economic development that raises the variables that Andy was talking about earlier, particularly education, income, access to information, is going to be, you know, it's not automatic. The other things intervene, regime strategies, political skill, and so on, but it's going to be subversive of authoritarian domination. That would be my response.
Just by way of a plug, I would encourage you to come to that event next Monday on Yashun Huang's book. And if you can, ahead of time, try to take a look at it, however you happen to do that, and see whether you think the conclusions that are throughout the book are actually supported by the data and even by certain parenthesized conclusions at the end of some chapters. So it's
The other half of my question is, are our policies helping in that regard, particularly in these two countries?
The honest answer is I don't know. But what are our policies? You know, it's basically open trade. And you know, to what extent do we have the ability to steer, you know, the shape of capitalist development in China by our policies? I'm somewhat skeptical. You have a thought on this, Andy?
I agree with you.
I think there's a lot going on beneath the surface in China that people are not capturing. I mean, you know, a year or two ago, I talked to a very, very wealthy businessman in China. I mean, really big real estate developer, tied into the party, lots of connections too. And he's pouring money underground into civil society. I think we, you know, need to have a more complex sense of what's going on there.
And I'm going to recognize Peter Bottelier. He had his hand up after in the next one. Just, yeah. And then there.
Peter Battaglia, Size. Like Bird, I'm not a political scientist, just an economist, but fascinated by your numbers. my question elaborates the point that Michael Swain was making. What are we really measuring? I'm struck by the apparent contrast between China's own perception of its system, political system, at least the sample of almost 4,000 people, and the typical Western or American perception of China being a very repressed state where people suffer lack of freedom and so on. The numbers couldn't be more striking in illustrating the contrast of between these two perceptions. Now, Mr. Diamond, your suggestion is that this is because China is in a transitional stage and just wait another 10 years and then you'll see the troops coming out and the shelf fall off their eyes.
Yeah.
But could it be that, in fact, China and Vietnam, perhaps, being one-party states, are, in fact, adopting attributes of democracy, transparency, accountability, such that you actually come fairly close to what most people would see as the key characteristics of democracy? In other words, my question is really to you. Do you think it is possible, from a Western perspective, to actually move to a democratic system in a one-party system, provided you adopt all the attributes of democracy?
Well, I think we should let the China expert answer
it. Do you want to address that?
I would say a few words, if I may. I believe there are a lot of intellectuals who are not necessarily authoritarian, you know, the oriented. Nor do they, you know, the truly liberal, but with a very, you know, a very keen sense of what's possible, what's feasible, and what's suitable for China. I think that they do believe that, number one, the political system have already adapted itself in a very, very fundamental way, along with the miraculous economic transformation. The system today, is quite different from the system 20 years ago, even though, there are some underlying feature, remain intact. Like, you still have one-party rule, okay, you still have censorship on print media, things like that. But same time, the CCP had introduced all kind of consultative advisory and different kind of monitoring mechanism, to make the system, especially the local government, more transparent, more law binding, with more internal check and balance, including a very effective auditing system. That has been being placed over the last decade to hold official to some extent accountable. Not in a sense of democratic accountability as we usually know of, but so I think they learn through this process of adaptation and incremental changes, and they try to to stretch all those past experience into a possibility that you might still have the one party dominance, but while you might be able to adopt a lot of mechanism of accountability, transparency, and making the whole system more responsive, without popular election for national leader, okay, without a competitive party system, but with many other elements that might enhance not only governing capacity but also to make sure the system more responsive to people's needs. I think that's what they are working on or thinking about. Whether it was success or not, I don't know. I would turn that question to Andy.
So the thing is, democracy means a lot of different things to different people. It's not like an economics concept. And whenever an economist says, "What are you measuring?" I feel very defensive because my discipline is permanent.
We all economists agree on what a free market is, right?
And so personally, I prefer to keep have a clear definition, to acknowledge that many people have many definitions, but to stake a definition for myself and for those people that I'm speaking to so they know what I mean by it. And I do go with the Freedom House definition. I've participated in Freedom House's Asia rating meetings for several years. I think it's a very, very good system. It's essentially objective. So China's not a democracy, and even though they do all these great things, and even though their people appreciate all the great things that they are doing, by a definition that is fairly concrete, that is not democracy. But I totally accept that that the people are perceiving changes that are real. So it all depends on what the debate is. So if the debate is, we have had this debate in the West for decades, will China democratize? What are we asking, I guess? So if you tell me what you're asking, I'll give you my answer to that particular version of that question. But if usually people are asking, will they have elections to elect the people who run the government and the central government such that the ruling party can be challenged and can lose elections? If that's what you mean, my answer is no. If you mean something else, my answer might very well be yes, but we have to know what question we're asking first. That's my answer to that question.
All right, I've got two people lined up here. Your hand was up next. Do you still have a question? And then you, sir, and then there's some others that have.
I'm looking.
Could you identify yourself, please? Thanks.
Stephen Call, Program on International Policy Attitudes. I'm still groping for the prescriptive conclusion here. Obviously, the picture is rather grim, and as people become more educated, they become more frustrated with democracy. We can say, do better, perform better or perform more, produce more economic goodies that make people just generally more sated and satisfied, and then they're not going to complain as much. But clearly there's a perception that the ideals of democracy, while still quite attractive, are somehow not being fulfilled in the forms, in the institutional forms that we have as available. And that does suggest that there might need to be some kind of changes in the structure of democracy as it's practiced. Is there, you know, when you get to the conclusion, is there something that addresses that?
Larry?
Well, I think it's important to emphasize this is not a policy study. The purpose of the study is not to generate a program of action for democracy assistance. It's an academic work designed to track and analyze both the trends in terms of, and levels in terms of support for democracy, trust in institutions, support for regimes. By the way, rejection of authoritarian rule, that's one part of the answer to your question, Michael, is we have items where we don't use the democracy word but get at basic concepts, and that gives us, in a different way, more precision in measurement. So, you know, the policies that might kind of be logically or arguably recommended, you know, it's not the purpose of this project to generate them, but it's the purpose of this session to try and put some on the table. So, you know, two or three that I would say, we were asked yesterday at the World Bank, well, does this mean you should have parliamentary or presidential forms of government? And, you know, my view is that's the wrong question to be asking. What we need is stronger legislatures that are overseeing executives more, but also deadlock can be very paralyzing. And, you know, each system has its problems and vulnerabilities. And when you look at repairing democracy, it's hard to derive general institutional reforms that should be applied everywhere. I'd say generally we need stronger mechanisms of accountability and oversight deterrence and control of corruption for sure. But then when the media is constantly playing this stuff up, even in countries where, you know, corruption is much less than it used to be, and less than in other countries, it can generate, frankly, public cynicism. So I don't think you can derive one set of institutions or institutional reforms that are true for all countries.
Can I take a swing at that? Larry's supposed to be our policy guy because he's in Washington this semester, but in this case he sort of took a whiff at that, I think, Larry. I think I heard Larry say, you know, your question sort of implied that the policy implications are not very useful if they are that these democracies should perform better. But I think that is a useful policy implication for the U.S. government, which, as Larry said, walked away from Thailand saying, you people have democracy, goodbye, we'll see you in the next millennium or something like that. That's not a good answer. I think we apparently still do need, as an American government, to invest some of this, democracy assistance and governance should remain a policy consideration, and it hasn't been, I think. Right, Larry? That was your answer yesterday. He had a bad night's sleep.
So, you know, we should be investing more money in this.
All right, well, I think this may have to be the last question, sir. We'll see how it goes.
Yonghan Kale is my name, currently with Georgetown University as a visiting scholar. I'm speaking as a political scientist and familiar with what economists are saying, sociologists are saying. My question has to do with the kind of attitudinal survey data that you collected, but more familiar with the South Korean case. The role of civil society it comes in two types. One, voluntary association, NGO, and advocacy groups of civil society, which did not play.
Advocacy groups, is that what you're saying?
Advocacy mm-hmm. groups. So my question is, does your survey capture the role of civil society in election, and secondly, if not, then is your survey, third wave survey, can capture more sophisticated aspects of the democratic consolidation, which Larry Diamond, I fully agree with your notion that we have to take a developmental perspective, evolving situation of our democracy as a political form. Thank you.
What we have presented so far really represent a very small fraction of our overall survey. We did ask a question about their membership in civic organization, their membership in informal network, and also whether they engage in all kind of civic activity, in particular, you know, participation in the you know, the electoral process, and also whether they initiate contact or with public official, whether they, you know, sometime took part in unconventional participation such as demonstration, protests. So, but I have to admit that the number of people who actually engage in those activities in most society, even in South Asia, when you use a nationwide sample, it's not very big. Okay, even though, you know, it probably the media coverage might give you impression that, you know, almost everyone in society, you know, got involved in some kind of civil, you know, disobedience or active, you know, as being an activist in all kind of organizational setting. But it's not the case, actually. But on the other hand, I think our finding do show that people who participate more in the political system and they are more active, you know, in civil organization, they tend to be more critical of the regime. But same time, they might be a more committed, you know, Democrat, you know, in terms of their deeply, you know, they deeply believe in liberal democratic values. So by and large, I would still argue that those kind of experience exposure, you know, tend to enhance the popular foundation of democracy in the long run, even though it might make the approval rate, you know, look more depressing, you know, in the short run. Yeah.
Well, with that, I want to thank you very much, all of you. It's I've learned a lot. I learned a lot reading the book. Bridge Street Books is just across the bridge into Georgetown on the left, and it's just out here. But I appreciate also the many questions, and let's keep this issue alive. I think it's going to be very important in the coming new administration, how we deal with exactly this issue. So please join me in thanking our guests.